It's been nearly 2 months since Interim Police Chief Jim Pugel retired from the police force after over 30 years. Pugel was seen by many as a reformer, trying to comply with a consent decree from the U.S. Department of Justice over the unnecessary use of force by the department.
Wow, there are so many good days, that would be hard to say. The bad ones do stick out because, fortunately, they're far and few between. Certainly the night I was a watch commander in 94, nighttime, I was driving around the city. In fact, Norm Mailing, the King County prosecutor, had asked to do a ride-along. So I was driving him around the Capitol Hill, East Precinct, First Hill area, and narcotics detective named Antonio Terry stopped to help some motorists at the Elbow Street exit on I-5 South, and he was shot. And he died from his wounds, and I saw him as he was rolled into Harborview. Norm Mailing was incredible. He goes, "You know what? I just realized I'm going to have to prosecute this case. I have to leave." And then when we were notified that he had passed and been murdered, that was tough. Those things stick with you. Certainly the Cafe Racer shooting. I just happened to be in the area as one of the several patrol officers had arrived, but I was one of the first commanders at the scene, and some of those folks were still alive, and so that was tough. And then, of course, when Officer Timothy Breton was murdered on Halloween night, that was another tough one. But then those are bookended by good police work and community. Yeah. In both of those, in both the Cafe Racer and the Timothy Breton murder, it was science, it was technology, and it was the community who stepped forward and gave us critical information of which we didn't have. And so all those components, the qualitative and the quantitative, came together and allowed us to solve those horrendous crimes very, very quickly.
You mentioned there were a lot of great days, but mm-hmm. could you give an example of a day when you just felt like I am in the right place being with the Seattle Police Department on this day? We are doing good work. We are doing great work. We are helping the community.
Boy, I honestly loved going to work almost every day. Working the parades was fun. Working the parades was always a kick. Everyone, as they say, waved at you with all five fingers, and they were nice to you. And you could give treats to the kids, and you weren't coming to see people at their worst or when they wanted a family member out of the house. Everyone was happy. So that was really rewarding. One of the most memorable was in 1983, my first daughter was born. She's now 31, but she was born, and I had eight brothers and sisters, and so you learn how to change diapers real early in life. I was 23 years old, and my partner, Clark Kimmer, and I went to a call where a mother, 18 years old, was home, and she was single, and she just had her child. And this is in 1983. She didn't know how to change the diapers. We had got to the house or the apartment because she had been beat up by her partner. He was gone, so we not only took the police report, but we showed her how to clean a baby and properly diaper it. And we would check in on that person every once in a while for the next, you know, couple months while we were assigned. That is, you know, part of what police work's about.
Jim, when did you become a Seattle police officer?
Sounds like a platitude, but it's really rewarding work. You really do get to make a difference in people's lives. There's a sense of duty. There's a sense of loyalty to the city, a sense of maintaining or being a part of the solutions instead of part of the problem. So it was all that, and it just grows on you.
Like more than 30 years, what comes to mind when you think about the way it was when you got there and the way it was by the time you left?
Oh, it's changed so much in every way. I'd say one of the biggest changes, one, of course, is technology. When I was a brand new officer, we had no computers in the car. We had no computers. Everything was typewriters. You were lucky to get an electric typewriter when you had to write your report. Most of our reports were written with ink in the patrol car. So, of course, information technology has changed. There was no such thing as a cell phone. The first cell phone we had was 1987, and it was the size of a car battery, and you had to check it out of a the evidence room if you wanted to use it. And there were only, I think, two in the whole department. Now every sergeant and above has one. The technology as far as fingerprinting has definitely come a long way, but far and above that has been the development of being able to take microscopic, I mean, just infinitesimal pieces of a DNA matter and determine who most likely it belongs to. I was in the sexual assault unit in 97, 98, and 99, and we were even back then, less than 20 years ago, we were able to only determine identity if we had quite a substantial amount of DNA. So I would say everything has changed, and definitely communications.
Well, I was going to say, what about relations between the police when you started and relations with the community when you left?
Surprisingly, it's more or less the same. There is always a frustration. We want the best out of our police department, and we want the best out of our police employees, whether they're sworn or civilian. We make mistakes, and they're usually high-profile mistakes because we're out there 24 hours a day, and we have the ability to use force, which really no other profession on a regular basis is allowed to use force to get their work done. So, and you compound that with technology, as I mentioned earlier, everything we do now is instantly recorded. If it's not by a passive camera that's privately installed or by a traffic camera, then it's by someone's cell phone. And it's not unusual at all to make an arrest. And before you get back to the precinct to complete the paperwork and do a booking if necessary, it's highly likely that your performance is already on YouTube and perhaps even being sent to TV stations or radio stations if the person who recorded that image is thinking that it's misconduct.
You know, there's this phrase, sunshine is the best disinfectant. It's used by those who want more open access to public records. Do you think that that same thing applies when it comes to the way that police work is scrutinized these days?
Well, I think in the long run, it'll have a positive effect. But we as humanity cannot forget that we are fallible. We do make mistakes. I'm not just saying police officers. Elected officials make mistakes. Newspaper reporters make mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes.
Fortunately, not radio hosts.
That's never, never, especially at KUOW, never. But we are, certain professions are definitely held to a higher standard. And I would include radio talk show hosts,
sure,
reporters, and certainly police officers and police commanders.
30 years is a long time to be at one place. And you've been out it for a couple of months now. Where are you now in the process of having left this place where you'd been for so long?
I love the Seattle Police Department. I love the city of Seattle. I was born here. Hopefully I'm going to die here in 50 or 60 years, have a long, enjoyable time.
At which time you'll be how old?
I'll be 110.
Okay, good, yeah. Good.
So I would say that it was a very enjoyable time. There's always politics involved in certain decisions or in events, but I would say that, admittedly, we, as many other police departments, have to continually evolve and improve the way that we perform our work and the way that we have our interactions in a positive way with the communities that we serve. I would also say that the Seattle Police Department is a very good police department, while, as I said earlier, just always has to improve. What I've been doing recently is working with Open Society Foundations. It's a group of foundations funded by George Soros. And I'm working with them through the Racial Disparity Project in Seattle and the Defenders Association. Chris Nierop, Lisa Dugard, Anita, and others. And we are going around the world, and certainly throughout the United States, sharing what our experience of community, non-governmental organizations, and police departments coming together to reduce the negative impact, the harm that the war on drugs has had on low-level, nonviolent drug offenders, And that includes people who consume but who aren't addicted. That includes people who are addicted, and it includes people who are both consumers, addicted, and dealers. So low-level nonviolent drug dealers as well. And it's the first, one of the first of its kind in the world, certainly in North America. And so I've been going around the United States and Europe, Eastern Europe, Central Asia, and we'll be going to the Southern Hemisphere and Central America in the next few months, helping drug policy makers, elected officials, non-governmental groups, and working with other professionals who have researched this topic and have practiced in it, allowing nation states to get a better grasp on how they can better approach
You know, I'm sure we all think we know a lot about police work because it's under such a scrutiny in the media, because it's represented so pervasively on television, in fiction, and in nonfiction. But what are the things that you encounter when you talk to people about being a police officer, about the police, that are consistently misunderstood?
For sure, the issue of when police are allowed to use force, the level of the use of force that is allowable not only by law, but what the courts at the state level, at the appeals court level, and then certainly at the Supreme Court level have said is allowable. And there's certainly a disconnect. We as police officers, and certainly me as a commander, we have explained it to so many people so many times that we wrongfully take it for granted that people get it. And we, as part of our job, we have to understand that there's a continual, never-ending educational process that goes on with new people that move into the city, new reporters, certainly newly elected officials, to explain what proper use of force is. That's one of our biggest challenges.
Is there an example of an incident that took place where the officer was following the proper use of force and it was perceived differently?
Again, I go back to there are so many videos that get posted up on YouTube or other social media that, you know, you could pick them out blindly. But one certainly was the young officer in Rainier Valley who had stopped the young lady for jaywalking. And I can't remember if she or someone else became combative and touched the officer, actually hit him. And the officer used a punch.
That's exactly the one I was thinking of. It was pretty dramatic. He turned around and walloped her. And,
yes.
And a lot of people saw that video and went, this can't be okay. But in subsequent interviews.
Terrible on its appearance. But if you talk to plaintiff experts, police practices experts, former police chief of Bellevue, who is traditionally on the plaintiff side when it comes to allegations of unlawful use of force against the police. He was even interviewed that night, and he said that's lawful force. Some people have called force like that lawful but awful because it does not look good. And that's I think, one of the things that we are always going to be stuck with in the human race.
And I think it's worth noting, unless I'm mistaken, that young woman later on ended up apologizing for her behavior on that day.
Yes.
Despite the fact
yes,
that she was the one who got punched by the police officer.
Right, right. And, I mean, things could have been done better on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
But when you examine the instant use of force, it's usually going to be found, usually, even by the most critical eye, to be technically right. What we have to do in this profession and as a community is to make sure that we as police officers are properly prepared and trained so that our actions don't lead to a use of force later. How you approach someone has a great outcome or a great impact on how the outcome of that interchange is going to occur. So it doesn't mean that we'll never have to use force, but definitely a lot of outcomes could be changed based on how the initial contact went.
And when you became interim police chief in Seattle, this was, of course, the point at which the Department of Justice had done a report, made a finding that the Seattle police had used unnecessary force. There's a consent agreement between the city and the Department of Justice to fix the situation. In your time as interim chief, what kind of progress do you feel as though you made on fulfilling this consent decree and fixing the situation?
Well, there's both explicit and implicit. Explicit was by the time I left the position of interim, we had developed the use of force review board. We had developed a new, somewhat cumbersome, but nonetheless, use of force policy that was validated by the federal judge. We also produced the racial bias policing policy. Now, these are new policies. They're somewhat cumbersome because they involve a lot more work. So the officers and the employees are getting used to them, as well as the public. But those are some of the ones that were really important and went to the crux of why we were in the settlement agreement in the first place. I think implicitly, I really believe that we had improved our relations with some very critical communities out throughout the Seattle area. Seattle police officers police Seattle, but they also police, in essence, five counties. There are 400-some thousand people that come into Seattle every day. They essentially almost double the population, whether they're visitors, whether they're working, whether they're going to the almost said Sonics game, to the Seahawks game, to the baseball game, or to the opera, or enjoying all the great restaurants. So we end up policing a lot of people, not just who live in Seattle, but people who come from all over the region. And I think we made some progress, although it's not called out for in the settlement agreement. We did rebuild some relationships and regain some trust that we certainly had lost, and we have a ways to go as well.
This is after you left, but the federal monitor who was overseeing these reform efforts wrote in a memo that was called a stunning indictment of current practices and systems that the Seattle Police Department is 20 years behind major law enforcement agencies that have computerized databases for tracking and managing and analyzing officer performance. Do you agree with that?
I think you said that happened after I left.
Yes.
I would have to look at exactly what the context. Having worked with and continuing to work with major urban police departments around the nation, and I just came back from the East Coast, there are many, many police departments out there that do not have adequate personnel monitoring, information technology, what we call electronic data storage warehouses that adequately give us the complete picture. That's one long discussion I've had with people from the DOJ as well as the monitoring team. Let's all come together on a national standard and have a national recognized vendor and nationally recognized off-the-shelf database that can be purchased at a reasonable cost, can be depended on, and regardless of whether you are a citizen or a tourist going to New York or Buffalo or Mesa or Seattle, you know that the officer is being examined and evaluated and trained at the same level.
You know, that might sound kind of abstract to people about a computer database system to look at personnel. Like, what does that mean for what a police chief or the public can do to evaluate how police officers are performing? What does it mean?
Well, we call them dashboard assessments. So at any moment, for instance, when I look at my portfolio in the morning, when I wake up, I can drill down in Morningstar's data and find out everything I want to know about a company's stock, what the price-earnings ratio is, what the five-year performance is, what the three-month performance is, what the income, everything you want to know.
But we're talking about a police officer,
right.
Not
so
a stock.
If we could find out what the police officer is, what is his or her sick leave use, have they been in collisions? What is their use of force use based on where they work in the city? What is the quality of their report? What is the quality of the opinions of their testimony in court? What is their evidence gathering techniques? Everything that is critical to ensure that you have high-quality police work going on would ideally be measured, and that's tough to do. And certainly it would seem that it would make sense. I believe you and I can both agree it does make sense, but it's a very small niche of the IT market out there, and there aren't that many off-the-shelf products that match what is desired.
Well, also getting it down as a fact in a database, facts are tricky things. People see facts in different ways. And in fact, the Seattle Police Officers Guild has very detailed points in it about how police officers are evaluating, can be evaluated. And I kind of wanted to get you to that larger point. How does that affect a chief's ability to manage his or her staff when there is so much going on in the contract that he or she as chief cannot touch?
Well, definitely. If the manager, the leader, the executive is bound by labor law, by contractual obligations, and by court decisions and then arbitration rulings, one has to take into account all of those issues when they are moving forward with the organization. Pat Fitzsimons, former Seattle police chief, once told me that changing some of these rules and work and implementing change in many governmental organizations, including police departments, is like bending granite. It's just really tough. And you inherit certain rules, certain regulations, certain policies, and arbitrated rulings that command that you do something in a certain way.
There is the contract being renegotiated right now, isn't there?
Yes, I believe so.
If you were police chief, is there something that you would like to change in the previous contract in order to make you better able to manage the police department?
You know, I haven't thought of that for 5 or 6 weeks, so it really hasn't been on the front of my
Oh, you didn't forget? It's only 5 or 6 weeks ago. Come on.
I would definitely, when it comes to discipline, we need a much more nimble, responsive, transparent discipline system. It's endless frustration to critics, to supporters, to reporters, to politicians. Everyone is frustrated by the opaqueness of not only the Seattle Police Department, but several other local jurisdictions and certainly nationally. This is not a story that's unique to Seattle. You, as you're waiting in lounges or airport at the runways, you read the stories that seem like they could be Seattle, but it could be Baltimore or New York or any other city that you're sitting in. And it's the same story and same frustration.
Well, I got to ask, someone's interests must be served in it being more opaque and less transparent. And I'm thinking it must be people at the police officers union who negotiate the contract to include that.
Yes, but you also have to remember that these contracts were approved by mayors and city councils, too. So everyone had a piece to make sure that there was some more transparency. So I think we all have to hold hands on that, and I think we all have to make sure it's more responsive, more nimble, more transparent, and more decisive.
None of the finalists for Seattle Police Chief are from Seattle. What do you think about this notion that we have to bring someone in from the outside?
I think there's mixed ideas on that. I think what we've been presented with here, I believe the mayor would be best served if the fact that he is considering people only from the outside.
Why?
Because there's perception and there's reality. And there, whether the reality is true or not, there is a perception that you can only get change at this moment in the history of the Seattle Police Department from outside. And you can go down into the social or the sociological reasons for that. The most readily apparent are the outsider really owes no one anything. And they certainly none of these candidates know anyone well within the police department. We have maybe met professionally or cross paths on different commissions, but an outsider really owes no one anything, but they do owe the city their best. And I think it will be easier for an outsider to manage the department at this time than it would have been an insider.
If I understand it correctly, one of the stated reasons why you were replaced as interim chief was the idea that you would be applying for the job and it wouldn't be a good idea to have the incumbent also an applicant. Is that accurate?
Yes.
And did you end up applying for the job?
No, I didn't.
Why?
I just didn't think it was the right time. The conditions weren't right. The environment wasn't right. And it's been fairly indirectly communicated that an insider absolutely was not going to be picked. Mm-hmm. And if one knows that, it's really not a really practical thing to engage in.
We should know by Monday about who the next police chief is. At least that's the schedule. Have any of the three finalists spoken to you?
No.
If they had, and they said, Jim Pugel, you were there for 30 years, you were interim chief, what's your advice for me? What would you have told them?
You've got some really smart people, some really dedicated people, not only inside the police department, but also outside the police department. You have a very vocal, very attentive, and highly educated clientele that you serve. Listen for the first 30 days. Try to absorb as much as you can. Do as much research as possible. Read all those personnel background files of people that you're thinking about promoting or otherwise inciting to critical points. Get to know the monitoring team, but also get to know the groups that have been somewhat critical of the police department, if not outright critical. Get to know Kathleen Taylor at the ACLU. Get to know the Racial Disparity Project. Get to know some of the successes that we've had in working with these groups that have been traditional critics, but have also been able to work with us to ensure better policing.
Since you left the department, as you mentioned, you've been working with Open Society. You've been traveling around and talking to people about drug policy, and I'm sure they're very interested in what you have to say about Washington State, which has taken, along with Colorado, a big step away from conventional drug policy by legalizing marijuana, and we're in the process of setting up legalized grows, legalized stores. Beyond that, I mean, what do you think we should be doing in order to create a more rational policy towards what are now considered illegal drugs?
Well, certainly not quite sure what the intent was when it originally started back in the late 60s, but the war on drugs has ended up being a war primarily on poor. The vast majority are people of color, people who could not afford representation or quality representation, and who were also victims of, like, mandatory sentencing laws, tying the judge's hands so that the judge was almost effectively made irrelevant. I think there's so much. I've been doing so much reading on this and then so much practicing and talking and listening to other experts around the world and certainly around the nation the last couple months. But this didn't just start as soon as I left the police department. I actually started getting involved in this in 2010, 2011. And I think we can do a much better job of taking the drug consumer, the illegal drug consumer, the illegal drug addict, and the illegal drug low-level nonviolent dealer who's really a subsistence-type dealer who's only dealing to make sure that he or she can put gas in the car, pay the rent, buy food. They're not doing it for profit. Have a much more thoughtful approach to not only how we treat them out on the street, but how we get them services, whether it's addiction services, whether it's housing, job training, hygiene, mental health services. It's shown over and over and over that that's less costly and certainly less damaging to the community than locking people up for long periods of time.
Did you vote for Initiative 502 that legalized marijuana?
I did, and I'm still not to the point of voting or being in favor of legalizing drugs. The reason I did, though, is because the police officers were in a really tight spot in the city of Seattle, and so it was just a very selfish vote. I did because the city of Seattle has always had marijuana since at least 2002 as the lowest enforcement priority.
In fact, I think voters approved that.
Yes, yes. It was voted by the people and approved by the city council. So what that did is if I was littering in the middle of you way out here and you were smoking a joint in front of a store, the police officer would have to go after me, the litterer, first, even though the store owner is complaining about the person smoking. Now, that could go for cigarettes, too. So it was very ambivalent. But I listened a lot to Alison Holcomb, and I thought that it would be the reasonable thing to vote for. It also got quite a bit of support around the state. You know, we usually have the cascade curtain divide. It surprisingly got a lot of support from the east side of the state as well as support on the west side of the state. In some areas, 60-some percent. Now, we all know that only maybe 11 to 15% of the people use marijuana. And you have to ask yourself, why did 60 to 65% of the people vote for it? It's because they want order. They want clear rules. They don't want it near certain institutions. They don't want it sold wildly out there or unpoliced. I think Allison at the ACLU and others who supported her did a magnificent job of incorporating certainly some of the recommendations that even go back to the British India report from the late 1800s, from what Mayor LaGuardia recommended we do with marijuana in 1944. So it was well thought out.
You know, the early signs here are good, but the retail stores haven't even opened yet and probably won't until July. When you think about what could go wrong, what concerns you?
One of them is to ignore the black market. One reason why it had such an overwhelming vote, I believe, and I've studied quite a bit of this, is because people wanted clear rules. They want order. And certainly if you're a business person and you're investing, some are investing over $1 million in these licensed grows, and they're playing by the rules, and the licensed retail sellers are as well. If you have a person who's playing by all the rules and you have another person who has a illegal home grow and is selling on the side, then that's unfairly undercutting the market. So not only is the person who is playing by the rules getting harmed, but we, the state, are not realizing the taxes and other income. That is one reason I think that this initiative was voted for. People wanted the positive sign. So I think one of the mistakes is that there will not be marijuana enforcement. And there's going to have to be illegal or enforcement against the illegal grower, the illegal producer, deliverer, and retailer, or else it certainly won't be fair.
You know, Jim Pugel, your interim police chief, and one of your predecessors as police chief, Norton Stamper, sat where you're sitting now and talked to me about his attitude towards drugs. And he said, not just marijuana, he said, legalize methamphetamines, legalize heroin, legalize cocaine, legalize them all.
Yeah. I think he said that after he left.
Yes.
I was able to, you know, say, hey, we have to change our policies and some of our laws before I left. I'm just not there yet. One of our biggest, in fact, in the state of Washington and certainly around the nation, is the illegal use or improper use of legal opiates, the Percodans, the Percocets, the Vicodins, drugs that are approved by the FDA, prescribed by doctors for legitimate medical purposes, and then through one way or another, either through abuse, addiction, or deferring or getting that product illegally to other people, that's become the gateway drug now. We just had a meeting back in Washington, D.C. with 200 police chiefs that I attended as a representative from Open Society. And we all agreed that right now the gateway drug is not marijuana. It's prescription opiates. We're having more deaths and more people presenting at hospitals because of lawfully prescribed or lawfully approved opiates that are being misused. So there's a big problem there.